Hi everyone, welcome back to Prevention Nation,
where we believe education and awareness can change the culture of violence. I'm Caitlin Wagenfield.
And I'm Roy Letts. Welcome back to Prevention Nation. It's Roy here, and Caitlin is not with us today. She's out sick, and she is very upset about that because we have a wonderful guest in today. But before I get to the guest, I'm going to say that Abby is here co-hosting with me. So, Abby?
Happy to be here.
Excellent. Well, we're happy you're here, Abby. So, and then I'm going to introduce our guest now. This guest that I first became familiar with through a training through Prevention First. That's one of our primary training organizations that we schedule trainings through to get all of our accreditations and whatnot. But our guest here, I could say your name, but I'm going to let you say your name so I don't mess up your last name and your title. So go
sure.
ahead.
Hi, everybody. My name is Rochelle Frabota. I just usually go by Rochelle because it's so much easier. Everybody messes up my name. It's not a problem, but I did say it correctly.
Okay, that's good.
And basically, I have several roles, but my primary role for the last few decades has been a sexuality educator in and around Southwest Ohio, and then whenever I get national gigs. And I do my work wherever I'm invited, which is lots of different environments. Mostly, and I'm so proud of this, at least for 25 years of my career, I've really focused on sexuality education with folks that we call in marginalized identities, or folks who just don't have the same access to power and privilege that many other folks have. So,
yeah. Well, and I love that you said that and just introduced that topic around sexuality. And I mean, that is so much of our work and what we are Safe at Maine here is we are a dual agency that not only addresses issues around domestic violence, intimate partner violence, but sexual violence, rape, sexual assault. And that's what we go into schools and we teach. And I think that's where the intersection is here, is that you're teaching a component or an element of what we're teaching, or I should reverse that. We're just teaching an element because you are far more thorough than we are. But we also have some limitations, and we can talk about that later. But
sure.
Yeah, so that's kind of where the intersection is, and that's why.
I agree. And, it was interesting to me in the late 90s. I couldn't figure out why I wasn't invited into sexual violence prevention organizations or networks. And then somebody in a group in Cincinnati invited me to co-facilitate women survivors of sexual violence. And so I went in, and they asked me to talk about relationships, healthy relationships. And so I got my first experience with a direct there's survivors everywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but in this group, it was so focused. And I kept asking, I was knocking on the door of sexual violence prevention and intervention workers, hey, why can't we talk more? Why can't we talk more? And I won't lie, I was a little frustrated. I don't know, I would think I was outrageous. I think I was, to talk about healthy sexuality when somebody is struggling so much,
right.
It was just, at least in the 90s, that's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow, some way, we now have converged. And I think that my work is sexual violence prevention work.
Absolutely.
Right? 100%. So, and we have a little more data that supports mm-hmm. that now. And I really love working with early childhood ed pre-service teachers who mm-hmm. have ideas in their stage of most. I work with pretty much traditional college students. So
yeah.
19, 20, 21, 22, who've probably never had sexuality ed, but definitely have had Stranger Danger and other curricula that, oh my gosh, why did anybody teach that? But
right.
The point being, they're so well versed in how to make sure that if they walk away from their drink that it's covered or somebody is watching it so nobody puts drugs in it.
Yeah.
But don't understand when they put a birth control pill in their body what that pill actually does.
Right.
So to talk about our fields, I think we're divergent.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so pleased that over the decades we're really crossing into each other now.
Yeah.
So sorry, talking a lot.
No.
I'm excited to be here, though.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We're so excited to have you here. And I just even in that comment, one of the things I just think is really cool and interesting is when you say that you feel that your work is prevention, sexual, prevention, sexual mm-hmm. violence prevention. And I wonder why do you think, if you would elaborate on why do you think talking about these things is violence prevention, sexual violence prevention?
Well, I think you just used the word talking. So first of all, we're bringing up a very uncomfortable, and boy, that's a minimalist way to define it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tragic trauma, a horrible conversation, things that happen at people and to people that don't have choices, mm-hmm. and how overwhelming that can be, right?
Yeah.
And so when we even talk about those things, people are already, they shift, right? You the energy shifts, the mindset shifts, people get nervous, people get scared, people get triggered. And to be candid, the same thing happens when I say words like penis, mm-hmm. or somebody says, hey, will you do a conversation about reproductive anatomy? And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. I mean, you know, so I hope that didn't sound disrespectful, but the emotional intense reaction is the same, mm-hmm. even though the conversations are very different. And so I think talking about difficult things is a primary way to address difficult things. And then secondarily, and as preventionists yourself, you understand when we give words to it, we give power to it. When we give power to it, then probably there's tips and techniques and skills. And although I'm not suggesting somebody could avoid being victimized, mm-hmm. or experiencing something somebody forces on them, I'm not saying that at all.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is, in my world, when we talk about healthy relationships, and I don't even, to be candid, sorry, I don't mm-hmm. even like the word consent,
yeah.
because it's so overutilized right now.
Oh, sure is.
But, and that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about owning your shit.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
And so when I teach not intentionally doing sexual violence prevention, I'm teaching things like body ownership. I'm helping folks say things like, you know, when I ask you where your private parts are,
mm-hmm.
most of you are going, most people, I don't know about you two, but most people will say,
I'm not sure, yeah, yeah.
Where the bathing suit is.
Yep.
And that's kind of a typical sexual violence prevention approach. Well, for 33 years, I've been teaching your whole body is private.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just yeah. those parts that people tell
it's
you.
It's a really good perspective. Yeah,
tip of your head, the bottom of your feet.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go on, like, so you're walking down the hallway in school and a person that you know, who's comfortable but maybe not your BFF, just comes by, touches you on the shoulder and says, hey, how you doing? And walks by.
Yeah.
And maybe you just didn't want to be touched on your shoulder.
Yeah.
You know, no bad.
And I have that right. You don't need to touch me. Yeah.
Well, that's Rochelle's healthy sexuality way of doing sexual violence prevention, right? Because
yeah.
it involves consent, it involves boundaries, it involves body autonomy. It did not involve being victimized per se.
Right.
So if we can build up those skills, they apply everywhere.
Well, and that's where we have so much to learn from you. Because I mean, because that really is the crux of our primary education in schools around prevention, around healthy relationships, is focusing on this concept of setting healthy boundaries for ourselves,
right.
and then communicating those boundaries to other people. And not that you should have to, because you shouldn't have to. I shouldn't have to communicate, don't touch me. You should just not touch me unless you ask me first.
Right.
But yeah, that's really what we're teaching in our healthy relationship classes is, help, you know, setting those healthy boundaries for ourselves, developing the communication around my bodily autonomy, and then obviously consent and what is consent, what is not consent. That seems to be a real focus too. Because I mean, this is probably unpopular to say, but you know, when we go into classes, I always think to myself, like I'm speaking to, you know, from my own personal experience, lived experience, I'm speaking to all these people that are potential victims, because if they don't know these things, then it just increases their risk for vulnerability, for victimization. But I, in the back of my brain, I always think that there's also the offender in the classroom. You know,
right.
there's also
yeah.
the perpetrator in the classroom. So I also, you know, really intentionally speak to, you know, if you need to hear this, this is, remember nothing else I say but this, you know what I mean?
And you bring up something that brings up teaching methods in my head when we talk about how the material is applicable in so many ways, but you know, it kind of gets gray sometimes. You know, I remember again decades ago, nobody was saying that, you know, when you're at your grandparents and or it's a holiday like Thanksgiving
mm-hmm.
and your uncle hugs you or your aunt, not to be
mm-hmm.
gender specific with violence, but you have a right as a 5-year-old to refuse that hug.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was archaic. Nobody would have said that 30 years ago.
No, you give
and
grandma a kiss, give grandpa a hug.
Right.
You sit on their lap, and it's like,
right.
yeah, no, some of the most unhealthy things to be teaching kids. And
that
unsafe.
Gray is hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. yeah.
And it's really hard for learners who have different abilities. So I do a lot of work in the developmental disabilities world. And so when we have folks, and I mention that because typically folks identified as DD will be concrete thinkers, right? Mm-hmm. So it makes it even harder to teach that gray material. We have to be very creative educators, and working with people where they are.
You're very right. I mean, teaching this concept of autonomy, making a choice about myself, making decisions for myself, it's very different whatever classroom you go into, which I guess leads me to my first question that I'm really interested in and that we briefly discussed before we started recording. But, I recently ran into a group called Truth in Ohio Education. And I just know that we have a lot of barriers in our classrooms about the kind of language we speak, the kind of populations that we address. But I also know in this question, I'll just preface it by saying, I know that everybody is in my classrooms. When we're speaking in these classrooms, there's people representing all different communities. But I also know that some of the people in those communities, they're not getting the specific or truthful information they need that's relevant to them and relevant to their relationships, because we have barriers that we can't say certain things, trigger words. So how do you feel about truth in education? What's the importance of it? Why is it so critical? And if we're not truthful, what risk, what harm are we causing?
Right. Well, when you speak of populations in classrooms, right, let's just call out one that's a marginalized group. That would be LGBTQ+ kids.
Yes, absolutely.
Right?
Let's call it out.
So to speak concretely, and I think this is almost across the board, there are nuances, obviously, in whether differences are visible or not visible. So folks with visible disabilities versus folks with invisible different abilities. Right?
Right.
So many ways, so many kinds of language we could use. So I want to be inclusive with all of it.
Absolutely.
But it's interesting. The story I have is 2018, our local funder approached me. I was teaching, I was a professor at Miami University in the Family Science and Social Work Department, and I was approached, hey Rochelle, what are evidence-based curricula that we use in the state of Ohio that are inclusive of LGBTQ+ youth? And we laughed really hard, because what a great question.
Yeah.
And the answer's none. So we endeavored. I asked my contact at the funder, what do you want? And so, long story short, I'll cut to the chase. I was requested to write, I wrote 6 lesson plans. I called it Visible and Resilient in Community and Self. It's a curriculum, and it is chock full of how to teaching methods that are inclusive of, in particular, LGBTQ+. I'm just now going to say Q+, just for the record,
because
I think it's as inclusive as I can be without stuttering over letters.
Right.
So, out of respect, Q+. We use Q+ in Montgomery County quite a bit.
I like that. That's a really good abbreviated, I think, all-inclusive, or mostly inclusive, right?
Yeah, so that's my intention,
is
to make it all-inclusive, gender as well as sexual orientation.
Q+.
So having said that, cool, yeah. Having said that, I presented the curriculum, and I said, here you go, what do you want to do with it now? And by the way, the curriculum isn't a quote-unquote gay curriculum.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going
to
go.
Right, it's not, how not to be gay or how to be gay. Yeah. It's 6 lesson plans that deal with how our conversation started. Actually, I use the first lesson plan to focus on the individual and then think of a funnel. And then the last lesson plan talks about how to be a good steward. What does citizenship look like? How do we use what we've learned in the middle, communication skills, a sense of autonomy, an ability to understand marginalized identities, experiences, and I use multiple, not just LGBTQ+, multiple marginalized identities. And how does that all add up when people say, I don't care what you do in your bedroom? The short answer is yes, you do.
Yeah, you sure do.
Because you vote. Or you ignore.
Yeah, and your language is very clear that that's a concern for you.
Or you wouldn't you wouldn't say that sentence.
Right?
Exactly. You saying that is
you wouldn't
what,
need feel the need to say it.
Yep.
It would just be implied. Mm-hmm.
So that's your answer right there, because when we don't include folks, in my field of education, there's lots of ways we could talk about medical, we could talk about social work counseling. There are lots of ways, lots of professions that leave marginalized identities out, some intentionally. But honestly, I want to say mostly, I don't think it's intentional.
Yeah.
The problem is we get, as somebody who works for a public health department, I have job security. The disparities among LGBTQ+ folks, pick any part of the lifespan that you want to. Well, let's go with super young. ACEs are 4 times higher in youth who identify or are questioning their orientation or their gender identity. 4 times higher.
That's
so
wild.
Why don't we have prevention education curricula that automatically think of LGBT or Q plus youth, right?
Yeah.
It's aberrant. So I'll cut to the chase again. Here we are in 2024. I have sought funding from the funder every year since. We now have a burgeoning program in Montgomery County that focuses on 7th through 12th grade Q plus youth. The six lesson plan curriculum is the core of it, but other things, as people who do human services know, other things have developed that, you know, those services weren't being provided.
Right.
So we're a gap filler, but mostly we're reducing the ridiculous amounts of health disparities among Q plus people. And that's your answer. We get very sick people. We get very isolated people. We have disproportionately high rates of suicide among marginalized identities in Montgomery County as well as in Ohio. I even know the governor's addressing the black and brown or African-American male youth suicide rate is off the charts right now.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen? How did we get that way? And I'll venture to say, and I feel like I'll be supported here, if we don't talk about the difficult stuff and that we don't build programming that identifies the difficult stuff with the people who are most likely to experience the difficult stuff, well, let me put a period on that little dissertation right there. That's
well,
it.
Oh my gosh, Rochelle. I mean, I'll tell you that you've really capitalized on all the risks. I mean, literally every risk I can think of, and more, if we're not teaching to that population, speaking to those people about the problems that are directly impacting them and that they're most vulnerable to.
I just want to say I love younger people coming into the field because this older person is a little tired.
Yep.
I still have the same passion. I still have the same commitment to making sure I'm learning and progressing. I still love to partner in the classroom. I'm very much into critical pedagogy. Every time I step into a learning space, I take away stuff all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
Isn't that fantastic? That's one of the best parts of my job.
Mm-hmm.
I keep learning. And,
yeah.
And it's okay if younger folks want to step up and do some
I'm
more
really
work.
Yeah, I'm really excited seeing younger people. Well, and it's funny that you say that, Rochelle, because, I mean, on a side note regarding just this younger generation, my youngest is 17 now. I have a 17 and 18-year-old and a 23-year-old. And I will say that I just see that so many of the ills and the things that have gotten us where we're at is gonna, I think, can be course corrected with this next generation.
I'm excited. I always have been.
Yeah, my kids have. There isn't a single peer that they bring over to our house, and we are the house. My wife and I have always provided the space for our kids to feel safe to bring all their friends. And all their friends feel safe there, regardless of their situations. But I haven't seen a single one of their peers that isn't so far, you know, progressive, way past where I am. And it just, that's kind of what inspires me to keep going and learning and growing myself.
Right. Yeah, I think the passion that I acquire from, and by the way, this is my work, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, to be candid, is kind of my 24/7 too, because
I was gonna
put it down.
I was gonna challenge you,
but you said it. I want to go back to your house and how folks can come over. I think there is such a richness and a promise where you can authentically be who you are,
mm-hmm.
and to be able to offer those spaces. And you know, we started talking about our learning spaces, our classrooms that we're in, but also, I mean, kids are gonna call BS right now, and I very much value and appreciate that. And my home is also a place where people can show up and be who they are, and we'll navigate it, by the way. So if you're being who you are and it ain't working for me, we will talk about it.
Yes, we sure will.
But that's the authenticity.
But we can, that's what
because
makes it authentic.
Can
we can have that
difficult conversations.
Yeah. Well, and with the spaces, your home, my home, and Abby's home, and our homes. Again, that's what we try to replicate in that classroom as best we can, is this safe space to have this conversation. So let's move on to another question, because I, you know, speaking to populations and classrooms or spaces, my degree is in criminal justice, and I spent years as a police officer and then years as a corrections officer. And so the concepts around, you know, control, human control, penology, criminal justice, social justice, all these things, the intersections of all this stuff. And I just get into this concept of jails. How, you know, and it said in one of your bios, it talked about your experience in teaching around human sexuality and that you've done this in jails or are willing to work in jails. And I just wonder how, if you would talk with our listeners around, how do you teach around about human sexuality or bodily autonomy? I'm not even sure if that's what you try to teach in jails. But in such a close community where rape and sexual assault are social constructs by which those people have to experience and have to have an experience every day of their lives that they're incarcerated. And it just, and I think I'm just going to throw in here at the end that what bothers me so much about it is that they're in a system that's designed to protect them, designed to control them. So the system itself and the agents of the system are not stopping. So what? I mean, I don't even know. Is this a convoluted question or what? How do you teach bodily autonomy in a prison?
Yeah, it's a tough. I mean, obviously the concepts you bring in, and let me just say you come in with an experience I don't have regarding your degree and your work. So you also invite me to assume the space that you're describing is the way that you see it, which I haven't experienced. Mm-hmm. So I hope my answer works for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
But let's talk about it this way. Clearly, we're talking about power. Whether mm-hmm. you're talking about the system, you use the word control. Whether we're talking about what a daily routine looks like, whether we're talking about everybody's wearing the same thing, correct? Mm-hmm. I mean, I got 14 years of Catholic education. I know what it means to wear the same thing
right.
to school.
And control. And, yeah.
and in so many yeah. ways, yeah. So we're really talking about power, right?
Right.
So, and that's exactly what I teach about. I just hardly ever use that word. And so as we've already touched on, the idea of power for control is definitely within a sexual violence purview, conversation, prevention, intervention. That's not where I focus. I don't dismiss that power is used against people over here. So I first of all encourage people in whatever learning space I'm in to just take away what they want, right? Because I ain't your mom, I ain't your girlfriend, so you don't have to do what I say, right?
Yeah.
And I may say something, speaking of marginalized identities or folks who don't have, I'll just say freedoms, because
mm-hmm.
that seems like a good word here.
Yeah, it applies.
Yeah, or their freedoms are removed because of their behavior,
yep.
so there's a consequence there, right?
Yep.
Big into natural consequences. I may be teaching things that aren't things they can use in their present day reality.
Mm-hmm.
However, also when I'm teaching, and again, sorry to touch on that, I'm teaching about how to talk about difficult things.
Correct.
Because I can't imagine, and this is my bias without having the experience, there are many safe spaces in incarcerated situations.
Yeah.
Just like I don't think there's many safe spaces in group homes when we talk about folks with DD who are single gendered in a space where staff have so much ability to have power and
correct.
Assert it. So I see essentially my work is similar, or for folks in recovery who give up power of their addiction. In there are different ways to approach recovery, so I'm going to think about a traditional one,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
But I give it up, right? I give it up to a power greater than me. I give it up to God. I give it up. And so what I have to own is my daily behavior. I don't have to own... I have to own my choices. Now, and kind of circling back, my choices in these three situations that I've identified are prescripted for me.
Right.
So I think, again, it's really important to say, don't do what I say. Take what I offer you and let what works for you work for you. So is there power in understanding, again, one of the most controversial, this makes me laugh, things I teach is the endocrine system, which... nobody knows.
Right.
I mean, everybody poops, right?
Yep.
We know the digestive system. We know the cardiovascular. As somebody says, how do you breathe? People are going to be like, I use my nose and my mouth and the air goes through and into my lungs. And people are going to know these things, right?
Yeah.
But nobody gets how the thyroid works, just that it's broken in a lot of
people. Nobody
but
an endocrinologist. Yep.
Right.
Yeah, so.
So I find what's really valuable in my work based on, you know, gaps in learning and opportunity is to talk about what is the endocrine system and how does it or sometimes doesn't work in your body. We have to talk about genitals. We
mm-hmm.
have to talk about reproductive organs versus sexual organs.
Right.
The clitoris is not technically a reproductive organ. But does it make it any less important? I'm just going to let that hang, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So having said that, here I am using language that is quote-unquote taboo. I'm in a place that's taboo. I'm talking to people who are taboo, right? I'm just, not my opinion, just creating the
scene.
Yeah,
yeah, generalize, yeah, yeah.
We're having difficult topics. They're walking away, those who choose to, with more information and education. And that is about building autonomy. That in and of itself, if that's the only thing that that person can do with the information that I have been contracted to teach in that space, because I don't just walk in and do what I want. I have people to answer to, right?
Yeah.
So having said that, it's like when I was at my high school in Dayton, one of the three Catholic high schools, I was at one, it was Alter, and I got in trouble for shoving my knee socks down to my ankles. It was not okay that I did that. And so, of course, I argued politely. Politely, mm-hmm. I argued. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get a demerit for it. So I almost made it through 14 years without getting a natural consequence. Mm-hmm. However, what I did do is go home and paint my middle finger, my fingernail, a different color than the other fingernails. Right? Look. Mm-hmm. Right?
Wow.
Did I get a demerit for that? Yeah, I sure did. Because they got it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Was this
your form of protest?
Was this a powerful form of protest? Evidently, it worked for them.
Yeah.
What did it tell me? It told me I have power. And it told me that the one demerit where I had to stay after school, which wasn't a problem because I only missed 30 minutes of band practice because I stayed after school. Anyway, look, the power, I have personal power. And I have to figure out when it's my advantage or to someone else's advantage, because, and let's take it out of this incarcerated situation, right? What you and I are talking, we create our homes so that people can show up authentically. That's using my personal power for others,
right?
That's what sexuality education does. Mm. And I'm going to tag for a second.
Yeah.
This is a little biased. When it's taught by a well-prepared sexuality educator.
Yeah.
Now, I appreciate my coach in high school who tried to teach me the reproductive system,
right.
But he failed miserably. Mm-hmm. And perhaps he even added to the shame and the guilt and
yeah.
the trauma. And I'm going to take trauma out of it. I'm just going to use shame and guilt that I felt about those parts anyway, because I was brought up in a culture that told me I should.
Yeah.
Right? And take out trauma. I don't want to put that in there. But it was traumatizing in the classroom to address my shame and guilt in a lesson plan that was taught so poorly, it just fed into, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm in a rabbit hole. Let me stop.
Well, I'll tell you what.
You got me fired up.